Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode examines domestic politics within Russia and focuses in particular on the pro-democracy movement. We'll hear from Vladimir Ashurkov, Executive Director of the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He'll be in conversation with Carla Thorson, Senior Vice President at World Affairs. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and this broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Carla Thorson.
Vladimir Ashurkov is Executive Director of the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Mr. Ashurkov worked with opposition figures to establish the Progress Party, or Progressive Party, in 2012. And along with Alexei Navalny, his close colleague, he is a prominent opposition figure today. Mr. Ashurkov previously served as the director of group portfolio management and control at Alpha Group Consortium, one of the largest Russian investment groups. I want to start with your biography because it's very interesting to say that on the one hand, you're a head, now a leader of the Anti-Corruption Foundation, and on the other hand, to say you were an investment banker in Russia. So you're now living in London, having been granted a political asylum there in 2015. And I wonder if you might start by just telling us a bit about how you ended up in London and how you came to be executive director of the Anti-Corruption Foundation.
I'll make it short. I was born in Moscow. I got a business degree from the University of Pennsylvania. I graduated in 96, went back to Russia, gravitated through a variety of jobs in finance and investments. For about 6 years, I worked at Alpha Group, one of the largest Russian investment holdings. I was always interested in politics and government, but I never really was a member of any party and wasn't really compelled to add to help any political leader in Russia. But in 2009, I started reading a blog by a young lawyer by the name of Alexei Navalny, who was focusing on fighting graft and corruption in large Russian state-owned companies. And in 2010, I wrote to him. I said, well, you're doing a good thing. I have a lot of experience in corporate governance. Here are some things that you do wrong. Here are some ideas that we could explore. And we met, and we started our collaboration. I helped him in my spare time. And one thing led to another. And in the beginning of 2012, because of this civil activity, I had to leave my corporate job at Alpha Group. So I focused after that primarily on the civil and political activism. And in the beginning of 2014, after Russia annexed Crimea, Navalny got under house arrest. My house was raided by the police. And soon thereafter, I had to leave Russia because a criminal case was opened against me in Russia. So after some agonizing, I applied for political asylum in London and work on a daily basis with our team in Moscow, trying to bring change to Russia.
To be clear, you believe and are certain that were you to return to Russia, that you would be arrested.
There's arrest warrant.
And that the charges against you are not legitimate.
Ironically, Navalny has made his name in anti-corruption campaign, and my charge against me is that I stole money from Navalny's electoral fund, even though we're like the closest friends and we work together on daily basis. Obviously, these charges are trumped up and used to drive me from the Russia.
So what exactly does the foundation that you head seek to accomplish?
Mm-hmm. Navalny has identified corruption as really the center point of everything that is wrong with how Russia is governed today. And it's not just economic corruption, but it's a combination of political corruption and economic corruption. So typically, a governor in a Russian region is able to divert the funds earmarked for road improvement to the pockets of his crony local business person, in exchange for, on the election date, making sure, using all his power, all his various resources, to ensure that the candidate of the authorities or the party of power gets maximum results. So he was fighting against that. That's how Foundation started. We have gravitated over time. We started with fighting corruption and graft in large state companies, but then we moved on to investigating particular officials and, bringing about the hypocrisy of their luxurious lifestyles and their small salaries, and also linking them to some criminal activities. One of the most vivid examples of what we do are our about 50-minute documentaries. One was on Russian Attorney General Mr. Chaika. We released it in 2015, and by now it has clocked over 10 million views on YouTube. In this year, we released a video on Dmitry Medvedev, who is current prime minister, about his vast property empire. And this particular video has clocked over 25 million views on YouTube. So that's about what we do.
So the foundation is also linked in a direct way with the Progress Party. And so could you also just describe what the platform is of the Progress Party and what its major initiatives are in the scope of the pro-democracy movement?
Sure. So the foundation is sort of the civil activism part of our movement, and the Progress Party is the political side. The main platform on which we stand is we recognize that the usual sort of feedback mechanism between the society and the authorities, representative political system, free mass media, and independent judiciary in Russia, they all have been falsified or eliminated. They're all controlled by authorities, and we want to restore all that. That's first thing. Second thing is that Russia, of all the major economies, has the widest income and wealth inequality, and we believe that's not fair, and we want to focus on social inclusiveness and bringing the society together. That's the second sort of pillar of our platform. And last one is that the government meddles too much in people's lives, both on the sort of civil side, all the repressive laws on restrictions on internet, et cetera, and on the economic side, where government is in control of over 70% of Russian economy. There's too much regulation, and we also want to reverse that. So these are the main things.
So your friend Alexei Navalny is the leader of the Progress Party. He certainly gained attention both at home and also abroad for organizing and leading really larger and larger protest rallies in Moscow primarily. There have been large pro-democracy demonstrations in 2011 and 2012 after the death of Boris Nemtsov. And in March of this year, Alexei Navalny called for demonstrations, and these demonstrations in March really took a decidedly different tone. What made them different, and what did these demonstrations portend for the immediate future?
A few things were different. First is the regional width of the demonstration. Usually the demonstration happens just in Moscow, but the infrastructure of supporters, of volunteers that we created throughout Russia allowed us to do it in many cities and towns. So in March, in about 100 cities, something happened, some kind of mass protest. And in June, already in close to 200 cities, there were some sort of mass demonstration. Of course, Moscow gets the most attention, and the number of people there is the highest, but still it's really sort of dispersed. Second is the turnout of young people. Everybody was surprised, including ourselves, that so many young people disillusioned with the policies of current government took to the streets. In many cases, those demonstrations were unsanctioned, and they ended in various levels of police brutality. Thousands of people were detained, most of them for a few hours or a day, but some of them got longer terms of up to 30 days.
So how big are these demonstrations in your estimation?
Moscow, about 25 to 40,000 people.
Okay. So both you and Mr. Navalny note the importance of social media and the internet as a way of both discovering and disseminating trustworthy factual information opposition supporters in Russia, especially the younger generation, use the internet for news, and that allows them to circumnavigate the state-owned television and the broadcasts that are controlled by the government. What is the value of the external voices and their potential to open more Russians up to the idea that something's genuinely amiss in the political system?
Maybe less than 15% of Russians own foreign passports, a travel document that allows them to travel outside of the country. The level of command of English is not very high throughout Russia. So the external voices really have hard time getting to the average Russian. So people rely, 70% of Russians get their primary source of information about Russia and the world is national television, which is all state-controlled or controlled by cronies of Putin, which feeds people lies and propaganda and, entertainment. Faced with these constraints, we had to turn our civil and political operations into a media hub. We started with text, with blog, as I said. Blog of Alexei Navalny still clocks over 2 million unique users per month. But over the last few years, we gravitated more and more towards video. And this is one of the reasons of our more active engagement with young people. We have discovered they very rarely read texts, but rather it's easier for them to watch a few-minute video. So we do this feature-long anti-corruption movies, which takes a month to prepare. We also do 5-6 minute videos 2-3 times per week, which usually get over a million views on YouTube. And we launched even an internet TV channel, Navalny Live, where various people host talks and programs on economy, on court system, law enforcement, internet, all the things that people find it hard to get really independent opinions and true information on the national TV and other media.
Is there effort on the part of the Putin government to restrict access on the internet to the kinds of videos and the blogs and the information that you are producing?
Yes, on many fronts. The censorship and policing and restrictions of the internet, of the social media and blogosphere has been increasing gradually over the last 10 years. First of all, it's direct restrictions by law on hate speech, on extremisms, and people in the last couple of years started getting real jail terms just for reposting information that the government finds offensive on their social media. For instance, if you repost a cartoon which compares Putin to Hitler, there has been a case that a girl got 2 years jail term. Or if you repost an article calling for Ukrainians to take Crimea back from Russia to Ukraine, you also get either fines or jail term. So that's one aspect. Mm-hmm. Second aspect is so-called troll factories, which, everybody knows where they are located. It's whole buildings with hundreds of people who come there and who post comments on Twitter and Facebook and the Russian social network VKontakte, and they use hate speech. And in general, they create the impression for the average user of social media that the public opinion is very much pro-government, very much anti-opposition. These troll factories, I believe that they operate also in the Western media. If you look at the commentaries on the online websites of various Western media. So that's the second part. There are plans to take it further, such as restricting the privacy of messengers, which have proliferated quite widely. And there has also been a repressive law which will require all internet and mobile providers to record all internet traffic for the last 6 months. That's a humongous volume of traffic. It's very expensive. And it's unlikely that it's going to work, but these are the kind of things that the Russian government uses to stifle internet, where still, you know, independent voices can find their audience.
Do you have a sense of, or any data, independent data, on what Russian public opinion really is towards the Putin government? There's a lot of talk about the public opinion and the positive opinion directed towards President Putin as being extremely high. Do you think those numbers are accurate, or is there any way for us to really know?
I think anybody should take the poll results in a country like Russia with a grain of salt or even as very unreliable data. First of all, because people are really afraid to answer from their heart. And it's true. Second is when there is no public discussion of important issue, people don't see the alternative. So it's easier for them to just say by default that they support the government because there's no really venue for the independent voice to reach to them. And the other thing is just a structural issue. Most of these polls are conducted using landline, you know, calling. Mm-hmm. And this tends to focus on people who usually older and who get their news from the national TV rather than, you know, mobile young people who are always in their phones and their laptops. So that's another reason. So the few sort of independent benchmarks that we can use is, for instance, the results of Alexei Navalny at the elections of mayor of Moscow, mm-hmm. when about 28% voted for him against 51 for incumbent mayor, against all the meddling, against all the obstacles that the authorities caused to the independent candidate, he still was able to get close to 30% of the vote. So this gives you an idea of what the support is now and what it can be if the political system becomes fair and more liberalized.
Sounds somewhat familiar. So there are presidential elections scheduled in Russia for the spring of 2018. And we know that Vladimir Putin is eligible for another second term. He has not yet stated his intention to run, but we assume he will do so. And there are several other familiar names on the list of declared candidates: Mr. Zhirinovsky for the Liberal Democratic Party, Grigory Yavlinsky for Yabloko, there's a Communist Party candidate, and Alexei Navalny has declared his candidacy for president. Can he win? Can he run?
Can he run?
Can he run?
I think, a more immediate question. You know, most of the people that you named have been in Russian politics for over 20 years, and they mm-hmm. have been cycle after cycle on the ballot list for president, so it's not really news for a Russian voter. It was a big discussion within our team in December when we discussed whether he should really announce his presidential bid, because it really is a political risk to say something like that and then fail to generate interest, fail to put together a really convincing campaign, especially for a guy who, due to politically motivated criminal charges brought against him, he has a suspended sentence. So by Russian law, he cannot really run for the president. So what's the point of doing the campaign? And when I saw the budget numbers which we need to spend for 2017, I was really kind of scared. How can we raise over $3 million over the course of the year for a campaign to get a guy on the ballot when he can't even legally run in Russia. Anyway, we decided to take the risk, and we are raising money. We are opening campaign offices in different towns in Russia. Over 60 has already been opened. We have gathered information from over half a million people who are ready to give signatures for him. And to get on the ballot, it's not really easy in Russia. You need to get, in the course of 1 month, 300,000 signatures from people pretty much evenly distributed throughout Russia, and register them with the Electoral Commission. So over half a million people have already pledged that they would give this support. We have 120,000 volunteers who has signed up to our resources, who are willing to help us in campaigning, etc., etc. We have conducted these mass protests that we talked about. And so you would ask us, what's your strategy? You guys still, at this point, cannot get on the ballot by legislation. So the strategy is really, the decision will be taken in December when the official electoral campaign will start. And our goal is to create this situation by December so that the authorities will see it as a lesser evil that a guy like Navalny will get on the bulletin, because they think, okay, we'll let him run, just like he ran in mayoral elections in Moscow in 2013. He would get 10%. Putin's dominance is still unchallenged. But if we don't let him run, then the interest in the elections will be quite low, because it's old guards who are running, who people have been seeing them for decades, and the white population, and especially the educated class, will see these elections as really not legitimate. The voter turnout will be low, because, you know, the only guy who is challenging the authorities is not allowed to run. So that's kind of the strategy. So we'll see in December.
So can I ask, just as a point of clarification, you went through this very quickly. What is the argument, what is the law that prevents him from running? Is it because he has been accused of a criminal act or convicted?
Mm-hmm. It's a law that is widely seen as unconstitutional, because Russian constitution says if you're not in prison, there's nothing that should limit your ability to run for any office. A law has been adopted about 2 or 3 years ago, and everybody believes that it's specifically against Navalny, that if you are convicted, and even you get not a real jail term, but a suspended sentence on particular crimes, you cannot run. And Navalny has been a target of several criminal cases, politically motivated. And on one of them, he was charged together with his brother. The charge related to some embezzlement, which nobody really believes in, and there are no victims in this crime. So his brother got a real term. He's now serving 3.5 year jail term. And so he's used as a hostage against Navalny by the authorities. And Navalny got 5 year suspended term. So he's free to, you know, roam Russia, but he cannot run. So that's the situation.
The other thing that's interesting about the analysis that you just presented is that you described the electoral process and the voting process in a way that suggests that you believe that the voting itself is fair, that the votes that are tallied are votes that are cast, and that it matters what the turnout is. This suggests that you do not believe that Vladimir Putin would win the election by virtue of simply manipulating the totals.
Well, Russian elections are rigged on several stages. First, of course, is the access to the ballot, who can win. They're very cumbersome. regulations like this, you know, getting 300,000 signatures to get registered. And it's, in any case, if you get those signatures, it will still be in the hands of Electoral Commission, who can say that half of your signatures are forged and nobody really can challenge it in court. Second is access to media and campaigning. And obviously the candidate from the government will have preference in all that. Next thing is, you know, access to financing. There are restrictive laws on financing, and especially we've seen many cases when people who contribute money to civil campaigns, to political campaigns of independent candidates, they get, you know, their business get visited by the tax inspectorate and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of pressure which limits the ability to raise money for a political campaign. All those obstacles are even before the voting day, when over the course of last 10 years have seen many techniques of vote rigging, including ballot stuffing, carousel voting, etc., etc. We understand that these elections are not fair. We still believe that it is the right decision for us to participate in the elections. Three reasons. First of all, the international experience tells us that in countries where opposition has decided to participate in the elections, however rigged they were, rather than boycott them, the transition from autocracy to democracy was faster and less painful. Second, just the sociology. We do a lot of polling, and our supporters really want us to take part in the elections. And we use these elections as an opportunity to pressure the pain points for the government, to spread our message across, to mobilize our volunteers. Sooner or later, elections in Russia will be more fair, more liberal, and at that time, the network that we create of people who can run campaigns, who know how to do door-to-door campaigning, other parts of campaigning really will be important. So that's our overall tactic.
Interesting. So you noted that there is great risk. And then when you described the risk, you actually described it in a way that wasn't what I was thinking you would say. Certainly other people who have challenged President Putin, who have challenged the regime, who've gained attention internationally, have either ended up dead, in jail, or in exile. I can go through the list of people, but why do you think Alexei Navalny has escaped thus far, either jail or worse?
For a religious person, the answer would be simple. And I often picture this fight of Navalny and the team that gathered around him as the story of David and Goliath, the giant, and the small challenger can beat an enormous beast. It's true that one source of Navalny's leadership has been the moral authority that he and our team gets from continuing our struggle under increasing pressure. So look at Navalny. His brother is serving 3.5 years in jail. He spent a year under house arrest in 2014. Our office and the apartments of our activists are often raided by police on some stupid pretext. The phones, computer equipment, etc. is taken and in most cases never returned. A few people like myself from our team have been driven out of the country. And despite all that, we continue our fight on different fronts, and that's what gives us credibility and moral authority. Nobody knows what goes on in the heads of, you know, people behind the Kremlin wall. So it's really pointless to speculate. One theory which can have a lot of, you know, probability is that They don't want to turn him into a martyr by throwing him in jail. And they don't want to create the next Mandela, etc., etc. But, you know, we don't know for sure.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Vladimir Ashurkov, executive director of the Anti-Corruption Foundation in Russia. He's in conversation with our moderator, Carla Thorson, of World Affairs. And now back to Carla.
Why should Russians want to democratize when there was an effort to do so in the 1990s that really didn't work out very well?
If we look at Russian history, we don't see a history of democracy, fight for the rights, development of civil society. It has always been a history of tyranny, oppression, and terror. The Russia that we see today, even accounting for this bout of tyranny and corruption under Vladimir Putin, the last 25 years of history of Russia has been the most prosperous and the most free period, quadricentury in Russian history. I think it's natural that after a very tragic history, a very tragic set of events that Russia went through in the 20th century, after tyranny, there tyranny of, you know, conscience and politics, it became a tyranny of capitalism and corruption and, you know, oligarchs and robber barons. I still think that it's better. It would be very naive to expect that a country like Russia would go from communism to democracy and well-functioning market economy within a short period of time. So what we see is really a natural stage in development of Russia. It was all right for some time, but I think Russia now is ready for something new, and this new it will inevitably be more democracy, more rights, movement towards European civilization, of which Russia really is a part of for many reasons. And that's just the natural course of the historic process. And we like to think of ourselves as the people who are sort of at the forefront of these forces, but it's not any individual or a group of people who bring this force. These are, you know, powerful forces that exist in the society and that drive this change.
What do you think Russians want most from their elected officials?
But they don't see the officials that they, you know, see in the parliament or the government as really elected officials. There's very little accountability of the officials to people. So the most people really don't bother to vote because it doesn't really matter. There's usually no independent candidate, and when there is, you know, we see that such candidates in some situations do quite well, like with Navalny in 2013. What they want, as I said, I think we develop our program so that it would resonate with the desires of the people. And overriding theme of our program is to bring the voice, to give voice back to people through political and civil means, restoring this feedback mechanism between society and the government, through reducing inequality, not just in terms of income inequality, but access to quality healthcare, education, etc., and reducing the amount of meddling that government does in people's lives. So I think these would be the things that every Russian would want, despite all the propaganda and feelings of xenophobia and nationalism that are fostered in the general population by the national state media.
So if the reality is that the government will control the presidential elections and Mr. Putin will likely be president for a second term, what are the next steps, the next tangible steps for you, for the Progress Party? Are there things that you have in mind beyond next spring?
Mm-hmm. As I said, our strategy in the situation when the normal attributes of political life, participating in fair elections, campaigning, access to media, are really restricted in Russia. We have to play on different chessboards and really be flexible in what we do. So we started with anti-corruption investigations, and that continues as a big area of our work, because when people see the mansions, when people see the luxurious lifestyle, they really become quite unhappy with the government. Next is we have to spread the word about what we do. So we turned ourselves into a media operations. We have the political arm. So when elections are there, even if we are not sure if our candidate or our party will be able to run or not, we use it as an opportunity to, rock this boat of the corrupt authorities. We develop the program of the future. What is the Russia that we want to see? What should happen to the tax system? How much money will we spend on social services? Where this money will come from, what will be the regulation, et cetera, et cetera. So all this process continues, and as I said, we don't know the time frames, we don't know the scenarios, but inevitably the tyranny would give in at some point. And whomever will be able to, will be organized at that moment, whomever will be will have political capital, those will be the people who will be determining what's next for Russia.
So in other parliamentary democracies, political parties, when they are not able to get their candidates in office, they're not able to win elections on their own, they join forces and work together to build coalitions. Is there a potential there for the Progress Party to work with other political parties that do have representatives in the parliament? Is that a viable mechanism and a way to develop a legislative agenda that might actually get put into law?
Throughout the history of our political movement, we have always tried to work together with various democratic political forces of different strains. It's little known probably in Western audience, but we built a few coalitions with nationalists, with liberals. It was like a round table in 2012. It was created a round table where different opposition-minded people sat together and discussed the issues of strategy and tactics. We tried to create a few alliances and coalitions with other democratic parties in anticipation of elections. But it's difficult, and those efforts in most cases fail at this point. And the reason for that is that in a normal political system, you create coalitions so that you get more votes at the elections, right? It all makes sense. There is motivation for people to brush away their differences and come together as a bloc. But in our political system, when we know that the results of the elections do not depend on our coalition building, but are determined, in Kremlin, it doesn't make that much practical sense to come together. And naturally, the ego of people and various, ideological differences prevail over the sort of idealistic concept of getting together in a coalition. But when the political system becomes more fair, when we can at least rely on the fairness of counting of votes at the election day, naturally then there will be motivation for similarly minded people to come together in a wider coalition.
So one of the arguments that we hear for the great deal of popular support for President Putin is the fact that people's standards of living, that the economy is so much better. So one of the questions I have from the audience is, can you speak a bit about the standard of living for the average Russian and how much has it fallen or improved over the last, say, 5 years or so?
As I said, the last 25 years have been the most prosperous for Russia. Mr. Putin has presided over a great period of wealth creation from 2000 to about 2010. It's mostly due to the rapid rise in prices for the natural resources which Russia was exporting. But if you really look at the numbers of the $3 trillion dollars that came into Russia as export revenues, only about one made it into, you know, people's pockets, improved infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. About $2 trillion has been really squandered. Just to give you some example, Moscow is the city with the second highest number of billionaires, and I think the first one is New York. The level of wealth that was created for people who was closed to the government is really very excessive. At the same time, the average salary in Russia is it does not exceed $500 per month. And one of the policy measures in our program is that we want to raise this level to about $350 over the course of 2 years. So this gives you an idea of the standards of living and what people can afford. Especially the last 3 years have seen decline in Russian GDP and deterioration in standards of living. Several reasons. First of all is, of course, the decrease in prices for oil and other natural resources. Western sanctions after Russian annexation of Crimea and support of separatists in eastern Ukraine had their effect. There's also a lot of self-inflicted pain by Russian government in more regulation and more corruption within state-owned companies. So, yes, there is growing discontent about the living standards, and eventually we believe that it will translate into politics.
Well, certainly one of the comments that we have heard is that President Putin is very powerful when oil is more than $100 a barrel and not quite so powerful when it's $50 a barrel. I'd like to turn now to the international environment and pose a question that I think is an important one. There are likely many Russians who support Putin's bold actions in the international community, including those in Crimea, eastern Ukraine, and in joining the fight against ISIS in Syria. These initiatives, many argue, allow Russians to feel that sense of pride as they see their country demonstrating it has political clout, using military force, and returning to its great power status. Are there alternatives to this mechanism to restore that sense of pride in Russia? Is it necessary for Russia to be a great power?
We believe that there are, and we believe that people are misguided in their support of the recent Russian assertiveness especially over the last 3 years. We believe that there is very little national pride if we look at Eastern Ukraine, that Russian soldiers that are operating in Eastern Ukraine in the rebel-controlled territories undercover, they are killed, and they're not heroes, but Russia, whenever somebody is killed or captured by the opposing party, Russian military signs decrees, you know, backdated that this person left the army, you know, just before he was captured or something like that. It's really a source of shame. Russia has been the cause of over 10,000 deaths in eastern Ukraine, including the downing of a Malaysian Boeing plane in August of 2014. If we talk about Middle East, it's really unclear what Russian objective is in this area. Russian government props up Assad's regime, while it's quite easy to predict that it will not be as sustainable. At some point, Assad will have to go, and the power structure in Syria will be restructured. We believe that the national pride for Russians should be in the fact that their voice should be heard in politics, in economy. Russia really belongs to the European civilization, religiously, historically, culturally, and is the natural path for Russia to come closer to the European and more broadly Western institutions and thrive in the environment with, you know, more trust, reduced military and security expenditures, more trade. This is the direction where we want to take Russia, and I think if we are given an opportunity to explain it to white population, this vision would be much more popular than the vision of, you know, aggressive Russia, you know, throwing missiles everywhere around the world.
So I'm going to ask you to speak on behalf of Alexei Navalny as a presidential candidate and to speculate about the events in eastern Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. Were the government to change and were Alexei Navalny to be president, what would be the policy?
Sure. These are two separate matters. With Crimea, we recognize that it was a brutal sort of abandonment of international agreements that Russia has signed. It was really not necessary, and it wasn't done in the interest of Russian people. But it has been done, and with some events, even we don't support it, you can compare them to, you know, toothpaste and and the tube. Sometimes you can squeeze the paste out, but it's very difficult to get it back in. And some decisions on which, in case of Crimea, took place over a few weeks, it will probably take years, if not decades, to alleviate this situation. We understand that there is wide support for Crimea to remain part of Russian Federation in Russia, but most importantly within the Crimea, where people have never really felt part of Ukraine following the breakup of Soviet Union. So the referendum that was used as a pretext for Crimea annexation in 2014, it was rigged, it was sham referendum, but if you conduct a free poll today, 90% of people in Crimea would say that they want to be part of Russia, and it's not possible to brush away those the opinions of those people. Our political position on this, and we are the people who are in favor of, you know, restoring the voice of the people. So when the Russian population, when the idea of returning Crimea to Ukraine be widespread and will gain popularity, then it will be on the political agenda. But until then, we don't want to spend political capital on saying that Russia should really fulfill international legislation that was violated when majority of Russians don't support it. With the situation in eastern Ukraine, it's different. It's a really shameful war when Russian regular forces are used to prop up a quite rogue and criminal regime in eastern Ukraine. So if Navalny is elected, if our movement comes to power, naturally we will work towards transferring those territories back to Ukrainian control and control over the Russia-Ukraine border within reasonable time frame.
So one of the arguments that is presented is that the reason for Russian engagement in Ukraine, for example, is that there are Russian citizens who are living in the near abroad, who are living in the countries that used to be part of the former Soviet Union, and that is an obligation of the Russian government to protect and defend those Russian nationals. Is this a legitimate argument?
Sure.
And does this affect what happens to other countries that are along the borders with Russia?
Usually they don't even talk about the Russian citizens, but Russian-speaking population in the neighboring countries. And it's really also a hypocritical viewpoint. Throughout the 90s and 2000s, a lot of ethnic Russians were driven out of countries of Central Asia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, etc., and nobody really bothered to protect their interests. And now, when the current Russian government sees the opportunity to take aggressive actions in Crimea, in eastern Ukraine, they do it, and this threat is sort of menacing the Baltic states, where in Latvia, especially to a lesser extent in Estonia, there is a significant Russian-speaking population. We, of course, believe that these matters should be regulated and addressed within the framework of international legislation. Never through military means.
Fair enough. So the other question that, of course, has occupied a great deal of attention here in the United States is the question of whether or not the Russian government has had a hand in our own elections. And so I do think I should ask whether you believe that the Kremlin has engaged in an effort to use social media and the internet to disseminate false information and manipulate the outcome of elections, not just in the United States, but in other countries?
Sure. It's a topic that has attracted a great deal of attention, and the issue of Russia has really become toxic for American politics recently. In my opinion, it's an exaggeration. It's very difficult to get to the bottom of what actually happened and what are the real facts and not fake news, and, you know, on both sides. My opinion is that if Mr. Putin was, you know, sitting in his chair in Kremlin and not doing anything to meddle in U.S. elections, we would have a different president of United States today, because the margin was very small between Clinton and Trump, and this leak that is mostly directly attributed to Russians, the DNC email leaks, really, I think, has lopped off a few percentages of votes for Clinton. But that's now water under the bridge. There's nothing that can be done about it. Probably Russian government didn't even expect this outcome. They were just trying to instill the sense of unfairness and chaos within American elections, but they really didn't hope or didn't expect Trump to win. With respect to Russian involvement in Trump's campaign, I think it's probably overblown. I think Trump and his inner circle have not been working directly with Russian security forces, they have been probably careless. They have been maybe silly, etc., etc. But I don't think there was really, active discussions on, Russians helping Trump campaign to succeed. And there is a puzzling fact of why Trump really sympathizes with Putin, and there is no really objective reasons for that. The explanation that I have is that they both see the world in similar terms. It's for both of them, it's a tit for tat, win lose situation. So they don't work on collaboration or trying to find out mutually beneficial solution, but it's, you take our jobs, we'll build a wall, or we'll erect trade barriers, or you don't pay for defense, we're withdrawing our forces without consideration of, wider factors. And the same for Putin. If he thinks that he's capable of, taking Crimea, and the opportunity arises, he does it with utter disrespect for international law. And the Ukraine, which used to be sort of the closest brotherly country to Russia, because people of Russia and Ukraine share so much of history, heritage, etc., and what Russian administration has created is a hatred between the two countries, which will take decades to heal. So we're watching these scandals unfolding with great interest. But these are the few facts that reflect my opinion on what's happening.
You are a brave man, and Alexei Navalny is a brave man to stand up and point out the corruption that you see. And I want to wish you all the best and also thank you on behalf of World Affairs. And I'd like to ask all of you to thank Vladimir Ashurkov for this excellent discussion this evening.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Vladimir Ashurkov, executive director of the Anti-Corruption Foundation in Russia. He was in conversation with Carla Thorson, senior vice president at World Affairs. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jane Heaven. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.